Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly European current affairs programme brought to you by DW, Germany's international broadcaster. This week on the show, war and peace. As Europe braces for an unprecedented rearmament drive, in Turkey, the Kurdish PKK group is preparing to lay down its weapons.
The peace process in Turkey will largely depend on what emerges, what kind of a deal emerges inside Syria.
We'll also be finding out why Serbian politicians got literal egg on their face this week, as well as meeting a Spanish photojournalist determined to bring dignity and recognition to the marginalised and forgotten. That's all here on Inside Europe.
We're living in the most momentous and dangerous of times. I do not need to describe the grave nature of the threats that we face or the devastating.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen there announcing an €800 billion plan to rearm Europe and assume responsibility for the continent's defence. The move follows last week's disastrous meeting in Washington between US President Donald Trump, his Vice President J.D. Vance, and the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky, and the subsequent suspension of US aid to Ukraine. As we record this programme, EU leaders are meeting in Brussels for an emergency summit on defence. The big question in the room: if the US security guarantees that have underpinned Europe's post-war democratic order can no longer be relied on, what then? Our security correspondent, Terry Schultz, joins me now on the line from Brussels. Terry, there is so much happening at the moment. Perhaps you could just walk me through the key points. What's it important to understand from a European perspective right now?
Sure, Kate. Well, it's been a week like no other, really. And I would sort of start the timeline back at that Oval Office meeting that by now everybody has seen. The breakdown in conversation between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and President Donald Trump.
What do you think it was about that incident in particular, Terry, that has been so shocking?
So shocking for Europeans, yeah, who weren't in the room. I think, Kate, you must have watched it. None of us could avoid watching it. I think just reflect on how you feel when you watch it. It made us all feel like we were watching somebody get beat up. I think I can speak for most people. I mean, there are plenty of people who will defend how Trump and Vance acted. But I think for a lot of people here, you saw a man trying to explain that his country is under siege and trying to say that he has said thank you a million times, you know, even though Vance said he hadn't. The Europeans clearly noticed that something changed from that moment for them as well. And I think what we've heard since then is that Europeans recognizing at a really, really fundamental internal level how their own security is linked to Ukraine's, and that, you know, for all the worry we had that Ukraine would be cut off from U.S. support, that now that it's really happening and you don't know how long it's going to last, if there's an endpoint to it, Europeans realize that, okay, now I cannot avoid knowing that if Ukraine loses, if Ukraine gets steamrolled, if Ukraine is forced to accept a peace that is not peace, yeah, we're definitely next. You know, that's something that we've heard said many, many times over. And I think I just can't explain how I think it was felt there, not just understood intellectually.
Wow. So the future identity, the future nature, the future essence of Europe is just intimately connected at the moment to the future of Ukraine.
Absolutely.
Europe has for so long seen itself as a bastion of peace in the world, and now it is having to reinvent itself and in effect take the steps which will repurpose its economy towards a war economy. Where does this leave Europe, do you think? What is Europe at the moment?
That's interesting, because it is true that Europe saw itself that way. But I will just share some comments that were on an off the record a background briefing with an EU official, and we're allowed to share these comments with identification only as a senior EU official. And this person said, this package, this Rearm Europe package, what they're discussing today and what will be the path going forward, is turning a page for Europe, just what you're referring to, Kate. But he said, it's not just turning a page, it's opening a whole new book. And that book is called A Europe of Defense. So I remember this off the top of my head because I found it so striking. Ursula von der Leyen had said that she wanted a more geopolitical European Commission for the next 5 years. I don't think she could have imagined just how geopolitically agile they were going to have to be. But nobody can pretend anymore that the peace project is sufficient for the times that we're living in right now and the transatlantic situation that we have right now. One other really remarkable thing is that what has driven what I would actually call fear in leaders right now is not the behavior of Moscow, because, you know, they've been punishing Ukraine. They've been relentless against Ukraine since the beginning of the war, even increasing in recent days. It's not Moscow that got us to this feeling today of uncertainty and insecurity. It's Washington. And, you know, when you think about that, that is also just really a different situation than we could have imagined.
New territory indeed. Terry, thank you so much for taking the time to walk me through that.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for helping me think about it in these hopefully coherent ways.
Our security correspondent, Terry Schultz, there. For the latest on the Brussels Security Summit, download DW's Breaking News app or follow Terry on socials. Now, from war to peace, or at least its promise. In Turkey, an end to 4 decades of fighting could be in sight. That's all because of a surprise announcement issued by Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned leader of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. From prison, Öcalan has called for the PKK to end its conflict with the Turkish state and for the group to dissolve itself. The call opens the door to an end of a bloody war that has claimed over 40,000 lives. But what are the implications for the wider region? Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Ahmet Türk, a leading member of Turkey's pro-Kurdish Dem Party, reads a statement by Abdullah Öcalan, the founder of the PKK. In it, the imprisoned leader calls for the organization to dissolve itself, thereby ending a decades-long conflict with the Turkish state. The PKK, designated as a terrorist organization by the European Union and the United States, has been fighting for autonomy and Kurdish minority rights since the 1980s. The 76-year-old leader knows that the PKK's military position within Turkey is significantly weaker than when he entered prison in 1999. However, Mesut Yen, a political scientist at the Istanbul-based Reform Institute, says that the PKK's successes in conflict zones outside the country mean that all sides have an interest in peace.
PKK is almost finished within the borders of Turkey. We know that. I mean, the Turkish state needs a peace process because it's kind of worried about the future developments in the region, in Syria and Iraq.
PKK leaders in Iraq have announced a ceasefire and said they accept Öcalan's call to disarm, but have so far offered no timeline for disarmament. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while welcoming the developments and describing them as an historic opportunity, warns that Turkey will retain an iron fist if the PKK fails to disarm.
If the given promises are not kept, if the process somehow evolves into stalling, delaying, misleading, acting as before by changing the name, then the sin is not on us. If necessary, we will continue our ongoing operations until the last terrorist is eliminated.
Despite a PKK ceasefire, Turkish forces are continuing to strike their bases. Asla Aydintaşbaş is an analyst with the Brookings Institution in Washington. Aydintaşbaş says that what happens in Syria will be key for Ankara.
the peace process in Turkey will largely depend on what emerges, what kind of a deal emerges inside Syria. So we're also seeing Turkey be more cautious. That doesn't mean, Turkey won't reverse course if it feels there's no room to go with Syrian Kurds or inside the peace process in Turkey.
Turkish armed forces are massed on the Syrian border, with Ankara demanding the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, merge with the Syrian army under the control of Syria's new rulers, with whom the Turkish government has close ties. For now, the SDF leader, Muslim Abdi, has declared his force is not bound by Öcalan's disarmament call, while demanding Ankara end its ongoing attacks on its forces. Analyst Mesut Yen of the Istanbul-based Reform Institute says ending the PKK conflict will come at a price for Ankara.
They're expecting that in return for that, the state promises that at least the kind of autonomy or status for Syrian Kurds, okay, is going to be recognized by the Syrian regime, the new regime, and that Turkish state is also supports this kind of a solution. And besides, in addition to this, of course, the expectation is that some reforms are going to be implemented in Turkey with regards to the Kurdish question, of course.
But Erdogan insists no concessions have been offered to the PKK in return for disarming both inside and outside Turkey. Meanwhile, the government is continuing its crackdown on Turkey's civil society, with the removal of elected Kurdish mayors and the arrests of journalists, politicians and human rights activists. Sezin Erner, a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal, warns that unless the causes of the conflict are addressed, there's little hope of peace.
Probably any disarmament or any disbanding of PKK would be a gimmick. And it might just appear in a year or so, whatever, under a different name. Because they would still have the pretext to argue that armed struggle is necessary because the Kurds in Turkey don't have their democratic rights.
While Erdogan insists he won't bargain with people he regards as terrorists, the Turkish leader does need the parliamentary support of the pro-Kurdish Dem Party to achieve his goal of a new constitution that would end term limits, allowing him to run indefinitely for the presidency. Kurdish leaders are expressing hope that with peace, a deal can be struck for greater rights. However, with previous peace efforts failing, opinion polls indicate that the public remains deeply sceptical of this latest bid to end four decades of fighting. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
A story that we will be following in the weeks to come. Now, we are living in times in which rowdy parliamentary sessions are nothing new. However, smoke bombs and egg throwing. That distinction fell to Serbia's National Assembly this week. The extraordinary scenes, and if you think I'm exaggerating, I really recommend that you look it up on YouTube, further highlight the ongoing divisions in Serbia, where a disaster at a railway station last November sparked an ongoing series of protests demanding transparency and accountability. Our correspondent in the region, Guy Delorne, can tell us more.
Serbia's National Assembly isn't a stranger to protests, but it had never seen anything quite like this. Pink and black clouds drifted across the debating chamber as opposition MPs released smoke bombs. Speaker Ana Brnabic, a former prime minister, attempted to restore order. But to no avail. The opposition blew whistles and vuvuzelas and unfurled banners alleging corruption by the governing Progressive Party of President Aleksandar Vučić.
It's better for the opposition to finally understand that we will never give up.
In the aftermath, Speaker Ana Brnabic appealed to the opposition to focus on policies, not protests.
Among their voters, there are a significant number of citizens who do not want the blockade of institutions, and they need to come to terms with that, come up with a plan, program, and vision, and beat us with arguments. If they have better plans, let them present them.
The crowd outside the National Assembly were unconvinced. There's been a constant series of protests across Serbia, stretching back to the start of November. That's when a concrete canopy collapsed at Novi Sad railway station. 15 people died at the recently renovated facility in Serbia's second city. Students have taken the lead in demanding accountability and transparency from the government, and older generations are offering their support. I think this is the moment when we have to stand by young people and their demands, which are actually demands for a normal life, says this woman. The whole world needs to see that we have a problem. What is happening in Serbia is not normal, says this man. It's up to the younger generation to raise the alarm, and it's up to the older ones to solve the situation. President Vučić and the government have shifted between accusing students of being manipulated by outsiders and attempting to mollify them. The resignation of Prime Minister Miloš Vučević was followed by legislation to increase funding for higher education and slash tuition fees. But the students have shown no inclination to end their protests or to join forces with opposition politicians.
Students, since the very beginning of these protests, were very clear that this is a non-partisan or student-only movement.
Bojan Elek is a journalist and analyst based in the capital, Belgrade.
They have been very careful to protect themselves from any kind of intrusion from the political parties, opposition, NGOs and the like. And I think this was tactically a very good idea because the political parties are among the most hated institutions in Serbia and with the lowest trust among the population. But at some point, there will have to be a political resolution of this situation.
What might happen next is unclear. The Prime Minister's resignation means the President must select a new head of government or call elections. But opposition parties say they'll boycott any vote not preceded by a period of transitional government. That, they say, would ensure the conditions for a fair election. But President Vučić has ruled out that suggestion. So the protests are set to continue, and the students are promising their biggest event yet in Belgrade on the 15th of March. Guy Delaunay, DW, Ljubljana.
You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock, and I promise things will be a lot calmer after the break.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdal, the host of Marketplace, your daily download on the economy. Money influences so much of what we do and how we live. That's why it's essential to understand how this economy works. At Marketplace, we break down everything from inflation and student loans to the future of AI so that you can understand what it all means for you. Marketplace is your secret weapon for understanding this economy. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, some balm for the soul. In a world in which the scale and pace of disasters all too often reduces people to mere numbers in a newspaper column, there is a man who has set out to retrieve the face and story of people who might otherwise have been forgotten. His name is César Desfouli, and he's a Spanish photographer with Iranian heritage whose most renowned project, Passengers, follows the story of 118 people rescued from a boat adrift in the Mediterranean on their migratory route to Europe. Here he is, in his own words, in this piece by our Madrid correspondent, Ashish Sharma.
I started working on migration many years ago. Of course, it has to do with the fact that I'm the son of a migrant, so I have had personal connection with the subject. My mother is Spanish and my father is Iranian. So I grew up in a house where two cultures were living together in perfect balance. And I think that gave me a lot of lessons. The way migration has been covered in the last years is very superficial and it's always based on a political debate instead of a human debate. So if we really want people to understand and connect with the people who migrate, we need to bring the topic to a human discussion and not a political discussion.
Last year, 18,000 people were deemed ineligible to apply for asylum.
2016 was the year when the highest number of people was arriving to Europe through different migration routes. The whole narrative was based on numbers. It was almost impossible to find the stories where the focus was put on the protagonists of those migration movements were human beings. Because if I was going to the Mediterranean, I was going to make exactly the same story as everyone else, then it didn't make sense. So what I did was to photograph the whole number of passengers of one single boat, who were 118 people traveling in one single boat rescued on 1st August 2016. I took a single portrait of every one of those 118 people and I asked them for their full name, age, and country of origin. With the idea of breaking the numbers, individualizing the narrative, and telling to the European society that those numbers you are receiving every day have a story behind.
Je suis ici en France, ici. J'ai pas de papier. J'ai pas de travail, ni rien du tout.
Over these years, I have been able to follow up the stories of those passengers. I go to the places where they live. I photograph them again to see how they have changed. And I interview them to understand better why they left, who they are, where they are now, why they choose the place where they are now. What I realize is that whenever I share the project and people understand and hear those individual stories, they connect with migration stories on a level that they never did before. And the fact that they can see a face of one human being and know their name breaks all barriers.
They viene te hablan, te tiene el palo, te tapan, así, así.
I was thinking about different titles at the beginning and I didn't have a very clear idea. It was like having different titles in mind. And when I chose passengers was because it's a word in which we all can be at some point in our life. We are all passengers, probably on a daily basis.
I remember this day. I always think about this day. The day I was rescued at the Mediterranean Sea.
A place where Malik from Gambia, I was able to communicate with him. We had an interview. I had a conversation with him in which I already understood many things of his story. And we exchanged contact. And then I traveled to Italy and I came to the refugee center where he was. And for a year and a half, I was making several trips to that refugee center. I was able to see how the life of Malik was developing with the time. That's the moment when I realized how important it was to not only tell what was happening in the sea, but also tell what's happening after. Because the life in those refugee centers was very tough.
Cesar Desfouli is a Spanish-Iranian journalist and documentary photographer whose work has been published in international media outlets such as The Guardian, Time magazine, and Al Jazeera.
So last year I was attending the One Young World conference in Montreal as I was one of the winners of the Journalist of the Year award. And I got to meet the colleagues that received the prize as well. There was Plesti Alakat, who is this amazing journalist from Palestine, who is doing an incredible work, and she was born in Gaza and she had to run away from there. And she's struggling to be able to continue her career.
The genocide my people are going through in Gaza right now makes any award feel insignificant. The pain and suffering there overshadow moments.
We are many people in this world who are trying to make some good impact with our work, and knowing that you are not alone, it's important. One day, maybe in 100 years, a new society will have to reflect about the fact that this world normalized that there was people migrating in such a way.
I think that the softly spoken Spanish photojournalist Cesar Desfouli was exactly the voice that I needed to hear this week. My thanks to Ashish Sharma, who recorded Cesar in his atelier in Madrid, and to the One Young World Network, who put them in touch. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Welcome back to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock. You'll never miss the water till the well runs dry. That's an old Irish proverb. And in the Emerald Isle, that eventuality probably seems further off than in most parts of Europe. Nevertheless, even in one of the wettest corners of the continent, questions of access to and management of water are becoming an increasingly fraught topic, as I found out recently when listening to a deep dive on the topic over on DW's Living Planet podcast. And given that we all swim in the same stream here at DW, the Living Planet team have kindly given us permission to share that episode with you here on Inside Europe. The presenter is Jennifer Collins, a reporter who I sincerely hope owns a decent pair of Wellington boots.
It's a while since you were on the ladder now, Gert.
Huh?
Is it a while since you were on the
So, I'm in Limerick, a city and a county on the west coast of Ireland, and in a kind of slippery situation, you might say.
Put your leg over, your other leg over, your other leg over there, to that, yeah.
There, right? You didn't expect this, did you?
No. I have to say, dear listener, I did not expect to be climbing down a rickety and kind of very slippery metal ladder and onto a small red motorboat with two octogenarians. I could see myself going into the river here. All the while trying not to fall into Ireland's longest river, the Shannon.
There is nothing here. That is here. That's what I keep telling people.
Pat Lysate, who you just heard there, is about to turn 82. He's a particularly lively man, full of quips and chat, as he shepherds us onto the vessel.
There's a fellow down the Isle of Feature by the name of Walk Easy. Walk Easy. Did you understand our lingo? Mind yourself.
Pat owns the boat and he does a bit of work on the river, guiding cruise ships and that kind of thing. But he's also a bit of a jack of all trades. At one point he was a printer, then he was a builder, and he also owned a pet shop for about 5 years. Now he's supposedly
beginning to retire at this hour of my life, if you know what I mean. Taking it handy.
He knows this part of the Shannon like the back of his hand.
Pat is Mr. Shannon.
That is Gerry Siney. Gerry, or Ger as everyone calls him, is 85 and is from about 10 minutes down the road.
I was born within feet of the River Shannon, well, inside of Limerick, but it's the same river. And it's been part of my life since boyhood.
Ger and Pat have known each other since they were kids. Ger would cycle down here, get in a boat, and travel across the short distance to the other bank, or the ruins of an old castle that still stand on a small overgrown island just in front of Pat's bungalow.
Most of my misspent youth was spent going wild on this very location. Don't tell her details now.
Were you part of the misspent youth on the
roof? I was too young at the time.
Well, I came too young.
So, having spent their lives and misspent their youth on the Shannon, Ger and Pat have a special connection to the river and the creatures that live in and around it.
See any seals anymore?
Yeah. We've seen an odd one. There's a kingfisher. See the kingfisher, Ger? He's gone in there.
But Ger, who's chairman of a group called the River Shannon Protection Alliance, fears all of this could be about to change.
All of this is under threat from the pipeline proposal. It's just, there's no simpler way to put it than that.
The controversial Shannon to Dublin water pipeline has received government approval. Ishka Éireann
would connect the Partine Basin with a treatment plant in Bird Hill in Tipperary and Piemont in Dublin.
If this pipe is built, it's going to be 10 billion euros wasted and nothing done to improve the water supply.
85% of 1.7 million people are dependent on a single source of water coming from the river.
Pipeline project to pump water from our longest river to Dublin and the other eastern counties.
I'm Jennifer Collins, and in this episode of Living Planet, I'm in Ireland exploring what is kind of an age-old story that is unfolding in other parts of the world too. It's a tale of rural-urban divide and tension over access, allocation and control of a particular resource. And that resource, perhaps unexpectedly in typically rainy Ireland, is water.
environmentally, it will be ruinous. The Shannon supports countless forms of life, bird life, aqualife. It features a number of European designated special areas of conservation, special heritage areas.
Jer is talking about the damage he and others in the Protection Alliance believe will be caused by a proposed 170-kilometre multi-billion euro pipeline that would take 330 million litres of water a day from the Shannon. The idea is to pump the water to the country's east coast to feed a rapidly growing population and industrial base in and around Ireland's capital, Dublin.
I am the River Shannon, on Shannon in Irish, the original language of this island. Named for the goddess Shannon, granddaughter of the sea god Manannán Mac Liar, I was born when she journeyed to seek wisdom at the Well of Conla. When she did, the waters rose forth, unifying with Shannon and transforming her into me, the River Shannon, possessed of all the goddess's wisdom. I rise in humble beginnings in the northwest of Ireland, springing from a small pool in an ancient jagged karst landscape. I expand and meander for 360 kilometres through 11 counties, splitting the island of Ireland into east and west. In Limerick, I become tidal, and in a vast estuary, my fresh waters start to mingle with the salt of the great Atlantic Ocean. I'm back on Ireland's east coast in a small, cute town called Leixlip near Dublin. It, like other nearby towns, could benefit from some of the Shannon water if the pipeline is built. Around 17,000 people live here. It's quite a pretty town with lots of green space, a 12th century Norman castle, a few pubs and restaurants, a major US tech company, and...
So right now we're in the Leixlip water treatment plant. It's the second largest water treatment plant in the country, and it produces on average about 210 million litres of water per day.
That's Angela Ryan, Asset Strategy Manager at Uisce Éireann, the national utility for public water supply in Ireland. Uisce Éireann is just Irish for Irish water. The utility will oversee the pipeline project.
Right now, Derek, our plant manager, is going to bring us on a tour of this water treatment plant that really serves about 40% of the entire population within the region.
Do you know you're going to be getting roped into this today?
No.
I think
we, yeah.
As we walk through the water treatment plant, Angela explains that the country, for now, isn't water-stressed. Ireland is definitely known for having a lot of rain. It's a never-ending source of conversation here. But the population on the east coast is large and growing, and the water network hasn't really kept up.
When we're thinking about 1.75 million people, 85% of that population are dependent on a single river.
That river is the Liffey. It flows from the Wicklow Mountains out through Dublin and into the Irish Sea. And it's way smaller than the Shannon. It's also totally overexploited. Some 40% of the Liffey's water is being extracted to supply the area. So there's no spare capacity or other source of water if anything goes wrong, like a pollution event, says Angela, which they are constantly monitoring for.
This is an interesting piece of history.
So we're in a long hallway with windows on one side. Assistant plant manager Derek Naud points out several small glass tanks. Now, I'm really bad at estimating sizes, but I want to say they're probably about 70 centimetres in length and not very wide.
Trout would have been kept in these tanks. And as the water came through, if the trout became unwell, there was a problem with the water.
Of course, the trout haven't been used in a long time for animal welfare reasons, but also because the treatment plant has, you know, more modern tools now for monitoring potential pollution events.
Are we safe?
We're safe, yeah. Yeah.
Safe today.
Even with all the monitoring, if there was a massive contamination event like a catastrophic sewage spill upstream, it would eliminate the entire water supply for a third of Ireland's population. The east of the country is already drier than the west, where most of the rain falls. And as the planet heats up, studies predict the west will see more flooding, while the east will see more prolonged dry spells. Climate change will also lead to more intense storms, which can impact water quality. Angela mentioned the storm in November 2019, which meant water coming into the plant was really cloudy.
So we had to alert a third of the population of this entire region that we were running the plant over capacity during this event and that they shouldn't drink the water unless they boiled it. So that has a huge impact.
Angela says the pipeline is needed because Dublin is dependent on one source of water that is vulnerable to climate change and pollution. But critics say the pipeline wouldn't be necessary if the utility plugged Dublin's leaky water system. Something like 32% of water is lost in the antiquated system before it even reaches taps. Angela says the utility is investing in reducing leaks to 20% by 2030, but that
even if we got leakage down below 10%, even towards 0%, we would still need a new project to bring in new supply into the region.
Ishka Aaron says it's looked at hundreds of options to boost supply to the Greater Dublin area, including other rivers, lakes and groundwater. But ultimately, it deemed the Shannon the most viable option because that it already has a large hydroelectric dam at the bottom, which stores, regulates and diverts the Shannon water for power generation. So Ishka Aaron won't have to build a new dam. That dam is called Ardna Crusha and is run by the ESB, Ireland's electricity utility.
We will enter into an agreement with the ESB that they will reduce their energy production to allow us to take that water. So there's no net impact on the River Shannon.
Water is life. People have long known that, and once often left offerings along my banks and on my riverbed, giving thanks for my fertile floodwaters, once abundant fish and drinking water. They have settled along my banks from before the time of the Vikings to the modern age. They have used me for travel and trade. My waters have been abstracted for electricity. I have been dammed, channelized, polluted with agricultural and industrial runoff. My alluvial forests have shrunk. So too have populations of eel, trout, and Atlantic salmon that once leapt up my waters to the exact place where they were born to bring new life into the world.
When we have a surplus, you know what I mean? But we'll head up and I'll show you the power station.
That's Pat Lysate again. Pat lives on the natural course of the Shannon. He's lived at the same spot pretty much all his life, where the river meets a canal built and run by the electricity utility, the ESB.
This was blasted out. Dynamite, explosives, whatever.
The canal and the hydroelectric dam at Ardna Crusha were built between 1925 and 1929 by German company Siemens. It was the first major infrastructure project of the new Irish state, which had just gained independence from Britain. Thousands of men worked on the dam, which was transformative for the island. Pat takes up the canal to the Ardna Crusha hydroelectric dam. The overgrown banks, which are about 20 feet above us, are full of trees and bushes. The rocks are at strange, sharp angles made from the dynamite. We approach the dam. An enormous concrete construction about 98 foot high. It once provided nearly all of Ireland's electricity. Today it's more like 2%. As we get closer, Pat points out a row of grey boons floating on the water.
Not really. You're not supposed to be go beyond that point, right? Mm-hmm.
Some workers in high-vis jackets are walking around outside the power station, and Pat wants to bring us as close as possible to the turbines.
No, I'll get you in here. What I do, lads, I can go in here on Sundays.
So I'm a bit reticent because I don't want to get him into trouble.
You know, you don't have to if it's going to get you.
But Jer, excited to get close, kicks my foot gently.
You're dying to go in.
There's two more guys up there as well, and there's a fella in red.
We slip by the booms, and Pat explains that just two turbines are working today. You can tell, he says, because just a small amount of water is trickling through the spillway above us down into the canal. And the canal itself is relatively still. before are working.
Like Niagara Falls, when there's too much water upstream, they release it here. These things bend.
The ESB abstracts up to 94% of the Shannon's water at a weir called Partine, about 14 kilometres upstream of where we are. It diverts the water down the canal for electricity generation. To drive the turbines. But it's also legally required to send at least 10 cubic metres of water a second down the natural course of the Shannon, which flows by Pat's house. That's so the real Shannon doesn't get dried up or get too low. The ESB controls the water levels at a lake called Loch Derg, just near the weir. The lake is popular with tourists and the boating set. Pat points out a huge cement tower. It's a fish lift, installed in 1959.
Before that, all the fish were trapped. They couldn't get up. They were dying here.
By the time the fish pass was built, the damage had already been done, and it's only gotten worse since then. Eel populations have plummeted. Salmon numbers moving up the Shannon scheme dropped from around 9,000 in the 1970s to about 1,000 over the past decade.
That plant has decimated the salmon in River Shannon. They've decimated it, and a few other species also. And it was one of the finest. The Shannon was one of the finest salmon fisheries in the world. In the world.
The Shannon has already seen major damage because of the dam, and is in poor ecological condition, say scientists. And the worry for Ger and the River Shannon Protection Alliance is that it could come under even more pressure if the water pipeline is built.
It will lower the levels of the river.
Ishka Aaron says it wants to abstract 2% of the Shannon's average flow, and that it will never take more than that. Ger and Pat say siphoning off that amount is fine when there's a lot of rain and a lot of water in the Shannon, but not in the summer or when there's a drought.
You know, what's that going to do to us? Dublin wants water, they'll get it.
Pat is referring to a feeling among many outside of Dublin, particularly on the West Coast, that regional development and resources are skewed toward the capital, where the government also sits. Ger and the River Shannon Protection Alliance believe the government and Ishka Aaron haven't properly listened to their concerns and proposals for alternative ways to bolster the capital's water supply. The group also questions the government's future water demand projections for Dublin.
This pipeline is not needed.
But the Shannon pipeline won't just be supplying drinking water to the greater Dublin area. It will also go to industry. If you take hydropower out of the equation, some 72% of water abstracted is for industrial use, followed by 22% for drinking water. And most of Ireland's big industry is on the East Coast. One of those industries, one that is booming in the country, is data centres. There are no figures for Ireland, but a study in the US found that 57% of water used for cooling in data centres is potable and could be used for drinking. Ireland has 82 operational data centres. Nearly all of those are in and around Dublin. They're seen as a key new growth sector in Ireland. Some 40 more have gotten approval. And whether you realise it or not, data centres make everything you do online possible. That could be matching with someone on a dating app, streaming a TV show, or even buying a flight. Often, these hubs, full of rows and rows of servers, are tucked away in windowless grey buildings in nondescript business parks. All right, so we've just arrived. I'm just going to get out of the car now. And
like one I've come to in Ballycoolan in North Dublin for a tour. It's a rare opportunity to get a look inside a data centre. But before I go in, I need to get through the high-tech security involving a biometric fingerprint reading, a camera. It's all a bit complicated.
Okay. Okay, this is the most high-tech sign-in I've ever had.
I'm here to meet with...
Peter Lantry is my name. I'm the managing director for Equinix in Ireland.
Equinix is a US company with 260 data centres in 33 countries, including Ireland. Tiny Ireland has become a bit of a magnet for data centres. Some say it's because of the country's young, highly educated workforce. Others say it's down to generous corporate tax rates. But there's another reason, says Peter.
Ireland is like in the Goldilocks zone. It's not too cold and it's not too hot. So Ireland is actually perfect for digital infrastructure cooling requirements.
Inside the data centre, which is basically a grey windowless box, it looks kind of like a prison for data.
It's a bit of a maze.
We walk past rows and rows of server racks and cabinets in what look like massive cages. It's hot and it's noisy, which Peter tells me is.
Well, the noisier and the hotter, the more efficient it is actually, because it means that we're managing the cooling systems to the highest level of efficiency and using less electricity and actually less water as well.
As we walk into one particularly noisy room, Peter says,
now you're in the cloud. See, now you've arrived into what is the cloud.
You know those pictures you see depicting the cloud with two computers connected by a fluffy cartoon cloud? Yeah, it's not like that at all. It's metal and plastic and colourful wires and fibre optic cables running overhead, streaming out of what look like cassette tapes.
Each individual one of those fibres is the connection of one business with another business and one network with another network, and that then connects globally to all the networks around the world. And then we will make sure it's cooled in the most efficient way.
Keeping all of those servers cool is really important. It's like if your laptop or phone gets too hot, it's just not good for the hardware. The ideal temperature for equipment like this is between 18 and 27 degrees Celsius. So that brings us back to Ireland being in the Goldilocks zone for data centres that Peter mentioned earlier. I won't go into too much detail here about the various ways to keep data centre servers chill, but the argument goes that Ireland's mild climes and westerly winds mean data centres can take advantage of ambient air to help with cooling. That basically means they can use air from outside the plant rather than energy-intensive AC.
Statistics that were released today by the CSO that electricity consumption by data centres increased by nearly a third last year. If you go back to 2015.
But they're consuming a massive amount of Ireland's power and water.
When you look at water use, each one uses
a full increase in that time, and it has led some to call for a ban on any more data.
Now, there's a lot of controversy over how much water and energy data centres use for cooling. And although Ireland is supposedly in this Goldilocks zone, data centres are still putting a massive strain on the grid. They used about 21% of Ireland's electricity in 2023. It was 5% in 2015. But are they really big water users? Now, that's where the picture gets a little bit more complicated, in Ireland at least. We don't have figures for Equinix's Irish water use, though they say it's small compared to bigger players. But figures from 2020 show large data centres owned by the likes of Google and Amazon can use somewhere between 0.5 million and 5 million litres of water a day when it's hot. The upper range is rare, but it's the equivalent to the water use of a large town in Ireland of about 40,000 people. Angela Ryan from water utility Ishka Éireann told me that Irish data centres are comparatively small industrial uses of water and aren't putting major pressure on the system right now. But that could change, particularly during droughts, which of course will become more frequent as the planet heats up. Plus, there's one other technology that is changing the game. Enter artificial intelligence.
Every time that you interact with ChatGPT and ask it 20 questions back and forth, that's the equivalent of pouring a bottle of water down the drain. Every query that you make.
A big part of the demand is from a growing number of data centers across the nation. And listen to this, from the rise of artificial intelligence.
Senior Nation. On twice as much data, it takes twice as much energy.
And so we're asking, is AI going to help solve the climate crisis or make it worse?
By 2027, AI could account for up to 6.6 billion cubic metres of water withdrawals globally. That's around six times more than is withdrawn in the whole of Denmark in a year. It's a conundrum Peter Lantry says Equinix is facing too.
We're going, well, our cooling system isn't really designed for that. So what we have to do now is install a new, more upgraded cooling system which uses liquid. And the liquid cooling is far more effective, and you can go up to much, much higher levels of power use for that liquid. And the power
Equinix is trialling water-based liquid cooling to deal with the shift in computing. Basically, the water stays in a closed loop and is reused. Equinix says it's looking at other technologies to reduce overall water use, But even with those improvements, Peter believes Ireland is at risk of falling behind other countries in attracting new data centre business.
I think it's well known in Ireland that there's a deficit in infrastructure across all the different types of utilities that needs to be looked at quite urgently, I would say.
Standing in another noisy room, beside some large water tanks, Peter says companies have to minimise water use, but the Irish state also needs to boost its water infrastructure and plug the leaks.
We're not a poor country, we should invest in these things. And there shouldn't be any kind of reticence or reluctance to do that. And once the Shannon diversion happens, and that Shannon, that piece of work is one that's been looked at for many, many years now. That's more than a decade in the mix. It just needs to be done, because what that does is it allows all the homes and businesses, they need to be given the supply of water, and that should be coming from the Shannon. If that's where the most available water source is, then let's do it. But the country needs to step up and say, this is what we're going to do.
I have been around for epochs, much longer than any living thing, but I am under pressure from all sides to make electricity, to give water to more people, to farms, and to the modern companies that have made Ireland wealthy. The animals that dwelled within me are disappearing, and new invasive species have taken their place. Can I continue to provide? The old stories warn to tread lightly on the land, not to exploit its gifts. Without clean and flowing water, there can be no life.
Back at the Shannon, Pat is shouting instructions at Ger and I as we try to haul ourselves out of the bobbing boat and onto the rickety ladder. He finally manages that for a few touch and go moments. We say bye to Pat.
Bye, lads.
Bye.
And Ger drives you back into Limerick City. On the way, he says the River Shannon Protection Alliance are fine with the river being used, just in a way that they would feel is more sustainable. They're proposing a significantly smaller pipeline that would connect in with other nearby water infrastructure and rivers as an alternative to the current scheme that would tap the Shannon.
Non-stop, continuously.
But Ishka Éireann isn't interested in a smaller pipeline. They're thinking big and aim to apply for planning permission in late 2025. Ger, in the meantime, has no plans to give up the campaign.
I was born and reared in Limerick. I spent a lot of time on the Shannon. The Shannon has meant a great deal to us when we were growing up and after we got grown up. Right. I mean, what more can I say? Probably too much, but there you are, you know. We'd fight this pipeline proposal to the bitter end.
My thanks to Jennifer Collins and the Living Planet podcast team for permission to air that deep dive into the waters of Ireland's Shannon River. Living Planet is, of course, available to find wherever you get your podcasts, as are we Inside Europe. And we are always very grateful for your likes, reviews and ratings. That's it for today. Inside Europe was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Sam Baker and sound engineer Siad Abu Sleiman. The feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.